Welcome to the Window, a podcast about dining in the South and beyond. I'm Robert Moss, the author of Barbecue, the History of an American Institution.
And I'm Hannah Raskin, food editor at the Post and Courier.
This week, it's the Risk and Rewards edition of the Window, because we're talking about some food risks you can take and the rewards you may get. Do you want to order your tea sweet, unsweet, or maybe half and half? And then where do you want to go to eat your lunch if you're in the Air Force? And in particular, what barbecue do you want to eat at? What barbecue restaurant do you want to pick if you're a politician? All these things, it seems, have great risks, but there are also some considerable rewards.
Okay, so we have with us today Jarrell Floyd, who's a health reporter for the Post and Courier and also sits right next to me in the adjoining cubicle. And the reason we've invited Jarrell in today is because he recently wrote a story about the scourge of sweet tea in the South particularly. My takeaway from your story is that it's going to kill us all, but I should let you summarize what you actually said.
Right. So I think for me, well, in the beginning, I feel like this all kind of got started because I myself am an avid sweet tea drinker. So it was kind of like a situation where I'm like, I know this can't be good for me.
It's too good.
Right. Yeah, so I enjoy it. You know, I've had it for years, grew up with it. My mom, you know, homemade it. And so just started reaching out to different physicians, different doctors to try to get like a feel for like how bad is it. And it's one of those things where I feel like in some cases, it was kind of obvious, like with the sugar, you know, too much sugar is bad for you. But in other things, you know, I wasn't quite aware of. In particular, I didn't know that the black tea in specific was just as bad.
Right, because what does it do?
Oh, I thought it was just the sugar. So you're talking about the tea itself.
Right, so the tea itself. So, of course, like, you know, with sugar, you know, too much sugar is bad, of course. But with the black tea, it's high in what the doctors refer to as oxalic acid. I hope I'm saying that right. But it's an acid that is like the main compound in kidney stones. So too much of it can lead to kidney stones. So it's particularly found in black tea. So too much black tea can lead to and strengthen kidney stones. So.
Oh, okay. See, I was thinking that, you know, because I drink a lot of unsweet tea,
I was dodging all the sugar.
So, some calories, but maybe not all the things.
And so when it comes to sugar, though, you said it's an immense amount of sugar, right?
Right. So I feel like, well, overall, it's one of those things where, you know, if you're moderating it well, it's like in moderation, you're fine. So the black tea, you know, it's helpful as long as in moderation, if you're taking it in moderation. But with the sugar, you know, you're looking at, I think, the nicest estimate I got from a doctor was around, like, 40 grams of sugar. And so with that, that's, like, around, I want to say, 160 calories. Okay. And then if you have, like, four glasses of tea, you're looking at 600 calories. And that's just for, like, a very moderate amount of sugar in sweet tea. And I think, like, the average for, like, an adult person is, like, around 2,000 calories a day. And so I think maybe for women it's a little lower, for men it's a little higher. But it's one of those things where if that's just the moderate estimate, if you're taking it like in high amounts of doses, if you're taking high amounts of sugar, like we've all been to a restaurant and we've seen the background where they're just pouring mountains of sugar in sweet tea. And so that's clearly way more than 40 grams of sugar.
I was going to say, I know Robert's worked in restaurants. Yep. I don't know if you have, but when you make the sweet tea, you use the water pitchers and you just
I was about to say at Zaxby's, that was our recipe you take the big tea dispenser and you take one big giant like pitcher,
pitcher
of sugar and pour that in there.
Exactly. I do remember my first restaurant job when they taught me how to make the sweet tea. I was like, how much?
Yeah. Right. And they teach you, too, you can't go over. I mean, no one's ever going to complain that it's too sweet.
No one ever says it's too sweet.
No,
They're going to I've actually and that's another interesting dynamic with sweet tea is not only – and I've written a lot about it more from a historical perspective. You know, sweet tea used to not be omnipresent in the South. It was you know, a lot of people, you know, that's why you have teaspoons. People would mix things. Mm-hmm. So it's gotten to be more and more prevalent, particularly people drinking sweetened tea, but also just the sizes have gone up and up and up. And, you know, it used to be one little glass you'd have at dinner. Now it's, you know, you get the tumbler and keep it filled all day long. So it's, you know, if you talk about the number of glasses, that's a lot of calories that people are adding into the diet.
And Jarrell, do we know if sweet tea is a dietary problem around the country? We know now McDonald's sells sweet tea nationally. Is sweet tea making a dent in people's bad eating habits everywhere?
Right. So from my understanding and talking, because a lot of the doctors weren't even like, they weren't naturally based in Charleston. So a lot of them kind of like immigrated like later on. And so from their understanding, every region has their own like comfort food that is like a huge health risk, especially if you're not moderating it. And for the South, sweet tea is kind of an exclusive thing. Because when you think about it, when you go to a lot of, like, northern areas, like northeastern states, they kind of, like, if you ask for sweet tea, you're going to get the iced tea and the sugar.
With sugar.
Right. And so with that gives you an opportunity to moderate it. And you get, like, to they could choose the amount of sugar you want to have in it. Versus here, you have no idea how much you're getting. You just know.
Yeah. And I have found too, I mean, often I'll just ask for half and half, which mm-hmm. I mean, you know, half sweet, half unsweet. Right. And more and more, I feel like people are being like, oh, half sweet tea, half lemonade. I'm like, no, that's just going to make it sweeter. That's not what I wanted at all.
Right. And so from like talking to like one physician, he mentioned that is a great way to like to moderate the amount. And a lot of people mm-hmm. should look into that, especially at restaurants. Right. Ideally, you want to make it at home. That way you can choose specifically how much you have in it. And you can like moderate more manually. If you're at a restaurant, the best way to do it is to do the half and half, which is the half unsweetened, half sweetened. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, like, yeah, there's no way you know how much is like you're taking in.
Right.
Yeah, definitely. I actually have one of the joys of my writing career so far is I've actually cited in a medical journal. Mm-hmm. Eastern North Carolina, where the medical school is there, up around Wilmington. I'm down the footnote somewhere, and it's because of some sweet tea historical stuff I wrote. But it was basically a medical paper on the rise of sweet tea drinking. And what I took away from that is that it has definitely gone, you know, these are folks studying like North Carolina, the amount consumed and the calories consumed has just increased on like a dramatic basis over the last 20 years to the point where it really is becoming quite a health concern.
Yeah, it's interesting because you hear so much about the growing consumption of sugary drinks, and I frequently think about like the chemically enhanced one and all the fruit juices, which are now have so much many added sugars in them. But even if sweet tea is not a long-term tradition in the South, I do think of it as more traditional than some of like the Gatorades or the Powerades, right?
Yeah, people who are still alive.
No
today,
question.
Yes.
But I mean, the idea is, 100 years ago, you could have had sweet tea. And so I suppose I don't always lump it in with all of these like crazy energy drinks, which I think of as being, you know, huge sugar.
Right. And you wouldn't be the only one either. That was like the running theme I got, especially with a lot of the more diabetes specialists, was that when they were having those conversations with their patients about, you know, building a food diary, you know, they would moderate, you know, all the unhealthy things they were taking in. They were still noticing, like, I'm not improving. My health is not improving. And then he would ask, like, you know, what are you drinking? What are you taking in? And he was like, 9 times out of 10, it was always like that sweet tea that people weren't considering as being like an unhealthy. Like,
right. Because it's if you make it at home, you know, it has recognizable ingredients. It sounds like many of those things that when they have diets, this is like what they want you to have. They always say, like, eat the way your grandmother ate. And she probably drinks that, right?
I'm doing exactly that.
That's the problem.
Yeah. That's actually something that medical journal article I was talking reference was that a lot of parents would give their children sweet tea. They say, well, I'm not going to give them soda, but they would think of that as something different. It's homemade.
Exactly. You know, right. Not, it has totally you know, different associations. So has there been much development of diet sweet teas?
Not really. I think it's one of those things where, like, from my understanding, the best avenue is like homemade, is like to do it yourself. Because even a lot of in-store drinks or things like that might have a lot of artificial things in it, and a lot of artificial sweeteners in it as well. And they're still trying to study what are the long-term impacts of that. Because I think there have been some studies where they haven't had the best health results with putting using those artificial sweeteners.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those things I feel like is still developing, but I think overall a lot of doctors are just like, you know, just drink water.
Right.
Like, it's hard to get them to kind of meet a middle ground, but I think a lot of South Carolina doctors understand the culture behind it. Mm-hmm. So they always, you know, they try to give them moderating tips, like make it yourself, mix it, do the half and half.
Mm-hmm.
I always had this nervousness about sweet tea because I just because it was like so people were so insistent upon it. You have to drink sweet tea if you're in the South. But now we have a health angle to
it. Yeah, good reason not to until they come up with sweet tea zero.
But it's true. Yeah, the artificial ones, those sweeteners. Yes, you don't get calories, but we don't quite know what else it does to your body from triggering responses, and because you always have weird effects. From
all right.
Sweeteners.
So what would the doctor say? So are you better off with sweet tea and grilled chicken or fried chicken and water?
Well, that's a tough choice. Yeah.
Right. All right, well, where do you go from the flavor point of view?
Yeah.
Let's start there. Which one do you
want? Oh, I do fried chicken.
You do fried chicken and water.
And water, yeah,
okay.
For sure.
Ooh, see, I'm still kind of bad. I feel like I would.
You want your sweet tea.
Right. I do want my sweet tea, but I'm going to take that extra step and do the half and half.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Good. All right. Well, I think that's all we can ask our listeners to do, too. Thank you, Drell. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Well, it's not just sweet tea drinkers who may be rethinking their diet. A lot of our armed services personnel here in Charleston and elsewhere, all throughout the country, are having an opportunity to perhaps make some changes in their diets as well. And Hannah, I know you wrote recently about changes that took place here in Charleston at the Air Force Base. I think it's called Joint Base Charleston.
It is Charleston's largest employer. Yep. 90,000 people.
Wow, is that big?
Isn't that crazy?
I knew it was huge, but I didn't know it was that huge.
I didn't know it was that big. 90,000 is a huge number. So when we're talking about...
This isn't like one dining hall that we're talking about here.
Yes and no. In this case, it was the renovation of one dining hall at the base. It's really their primary sort of cafeteria. Okay. But all of this was an outgrowth of the food transformation initiative that the Air Force launched, so to speak, in 2010. And so it's been a staggered relief. So it's just they had closed the dining hall at Joint Base Charleston for 2 years and just reopened this February 2019 after a 2 year closure. Again, the idea was to completely renovate that dining hall. But the administrative changes that rolled out with the reopening is that, one, now service members and everyone else on the base, their ID card gets them into different dining halls, just like they do on college campuses.
It's like a college campus, yeah.
Just like a college campus. So I don't think they renovated their places, but now you can go eat at the club or you can eat at the bowling alley or whatever. They changed that. And in the other direction, they've now opened the dining hall to contractors, civilians who previously would not have been admitted to the dining hall, nor did they want to come in, I don't think. They made it sound like a terrible place.
Informed solely by television and movies, my vision of military dining is that tin tray and you slop some beans or something unrecognizable and you got a guy named Cookie
I always remember like the mess hall for MASH. Yes. You know, they're not at war over at Joint Base Charleston.
So that's true.
It's not like there's gunfire overhead or anything like that.
You know, they do make those in South Carolina.
What's that?
The MREs.
Oh, the MREs.
Oh, yeah. It's not MREs. No. It's not the Korean War tent. It's not that. But it was just a pretty lousy institutional cafeteria. Yep. So they had kind of walls everywhere, so it was dark. And the way they describe it to me is when you went in, you could go left or you could go right. And if you went left, everything was fried. And if you went right, everything was grilled. But kind of like, so it's like basically you were choosing between hamburgers and fried chicken every day.
Yep.
And like everyone else, service members want to eat a little bit better. And so the reason the Air Force introduced this whole initiative is because people weren't coming to the dining hall. I mean, they were just going off base, which is a tremendous waste, obviously, financially. I think Air Force-wide, they said something like 28% of service members were eating on campus. Obviously, they want to get that number way up because they were just throwing away food and the whole thing was not working.
And Air Force folks are having to pay out of pocket for meals when they're in theory, also, they're serving our country, we should be serving them salad.
So they did this big change, and again, almost every element of this change would be recognizable to someone who's been on a college campus in the last 20 years. So they pulled down the walls, they put in electrical outlets so people can plug in their laptop. You know, they have one of the things they said they're proudest of now is they've reconfigured their soda stations. So when you have water, you can get room temperature water, cold water, or sparkling water. So it's like this new emphasis on the healthy
stuff. So if you're trying to give up that sweet tea,
they have all sorts of choices.
You've got all sorts of sparkling water and other things.
So it's cool. So it looks now, as I said, like all these kind of modern cafeterias look. And the service members love it. They're going crazy for it, which is really great. So that's the change. And as I said, with 90,000 people on the base, this really makes a difference. They said that since they opened this hall about 4 weeks ago now, they've pretty much quadrupled the number of people they're serving, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, those
huge.
Numbers are big.
Huge, right. So it used to be 250 people a day came through at cafeteria. Now they're up to 1,000. Again, that's not 90,000 people.
Still a fraction of the people, right? If my math's correct.
I don't entirely understand the way this all works, but they were happy. It seemed, everyone was happy. Like, I was in there taking pictures, and people were reaching for the zucchini and the salad bar and posing with it. I mean, they just seemed so happy. One of the things that it used to be the case, and again, this is true with so many cafeterias that have made similar conversions, is the cooks never held to the recipe because the recipes they were provided were so bland.
Oh, yeah.
And so in trying to make the dishes better, they just loaded on salt and MSG, which didn't make them any healthier. So now they're very particular about you follow the recipe just as it's written, and the food should be fresh and actually taste good.
Well, it is interesting because it does definitely follow the what you're seeing on college campuses, another institutional.
All institutions.
In fact, I think Sodexo is
Sodexo is a provider in this case. So it sounds like there's not an Air Force-wide contract, but that each base was able to put out an RFP. And in this case, it's Sodexo.
Yeah, I know Sodexo does a lot of the college. You know, they're a big institutional.
Yeah.
Which is also different because, you know, the old cliche, you had like your mess sergeant and your mess, you know, your privates peeling potatoes and all that, but not anymore.
Actually, yes. Oh, it's funny you bring that up. They've actually changed it. So now there are more cooking opportunities for the service.
Oh, so there are actually still servicemen who are cooking.
Actually, it's not more just so. And I didn't totally understand how this worked, but I guess they've tried to create more more opportunities in which they're actually learning something about cooking, but at the same time, cooking for their fellow service members. So they say this is useful when they deploy.
Yeah, I would guess so.
They know how to peel a potato.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so.
Interesting, because at the same time that you're writing this, it's funny. My older son is a senior in high school. He's looking at college campuses and all that, and so we've been looking at.
If he's looking at cafeterias, I would recommend Duke.
Duke.
Oh, the cafeteria at Duke is just something to behold. It really is amazing.
Well, for him, unlike me, the cafeteria is an afterthought. But as we've been looking, it's been interesting to sort of to look at all that.
I mean, Duke, every state, first of all, there must be like 14, 18, 27 different stations in the main cafeteria. It's really amazing. And each one is personalized. So they make a crepe for you. And I think then like they put your initials on. I mean,
that's Duke though, right? Let's take it down.
Anything you know about Duke is true about the cafeteria.
That's probably not typical. Yeah, because actually we were looking at College of Charleston, right? Mm-hmm. You're in Charleston looking at the dining options there. But in some ways, it's not that different than when I was in college in the sense that they have various stations. We used to have Hotline, Grill, Salad Bar, but A, there are more of them, and B, what they serve on is quite different than what was available.
Well, and I would say I have not been over to the College of Charleston's venues other than Marty's Place, which they opened as like sort of a vegetarian, kosher option a couple of years back. But one of the leaders of that organization, I don't know exactly what her title is, but she was part of Seaweed this past weekend. She was doing a cooking demo. And, you know, in some of the stage chatter, got talking about students at the College of Charleston and what they ask for. And she said it's really striking. They come in, especially College of Charleston students, many of whom are fairly privileged. They come in with these very, like, she called them foodie tendencies, I think, you know. And so they're asking for scallops. They're asking for lobster. College students
Bay boat scallops, please.
Yeah, exactly. So she said it's really interesting what they're wanting. Because at least when I was in school, just the idea that you could have all the hamburgers you wanted was pretty exciting, you know.
It was super exciting for me. My first semester was like, oh wow, all you can eat hamburgers, and then you realize it's the same every week.
Exactly.
You know, Tuesdays always, whatever, you know, spaghetti day.
Yeah,
and it got old after. But boy, was it a wonderland! You know, and the unlimited soft serve.
I was trying to say cereal because that
the
was
cereal
so,
bins
that
in
they
the
kept
morning.
All. Oh, yeah. And morning, noon, and night. Yeah, that was the exciting thing. You have around, cereal for dessert.
So I got over that after the first year, but and started cooking. But it's definitely a joy. One of the things I did notice, both like thinking about what College of Charleston, what you sort of looking at their menu, but then also noticed on the Air Force has their global selection, which I guess rotates quarterly. It was like an Asian style noodle selection, I think is the one you mentioned.
Yep, they're doing various stir fries and noodles. I mean, you would think, you would recognize this like, this is supposed to be Asian-esque.
Sort of a noodle bowl kind of deal.
Yep.
Same thing as the College of Charleston dining halls tend to have a lot of stir fry, a lot of Asian inspired flavors, which is certainly something new that I think is changed.
Yeah, I would. I mean, I didn't talk to them about this, but I would guess it's going to turn over to Latin at some point. Yep. You know, I mean, they have to have a taco station.
You got
they
to.
Don't.
Yeah.
So
that's definitely a shift in dining since I was in college.
It is, and it's interesting about this Air Force base. They were quite candid about this, which I thought was interesting. Was that for the 2-year closure, they gave a $700 a month allowance to the people.
Yeah, I thought that was curious.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
People who were in dorms who I guess have nowhere else to eat. Some of the dorms have kitchens. This is why the 90,000 number is a little misleading. Mm-hmm. Some of them have their own kitchens, and some of them are in like family housing, so of course they're going to eat, you know, at home. But some are in dorms that have no kitchen facilities whatsoever. So they were issued a $700 a month allowance. So they could go off base as well. You know, there's a Waffle House right there, and you know, and
yeah, when, there's a lot of restaurants up in
there. Oh, there are a number of restaurants. Yeah. And at the time when they issued these cards, they're like, we just hope they make decisions wisely, because I guess they could spend on anything. Yeah. It's sort of like how all we felt with all the burgers and all the cereal. Right, exactly. And so they were very concerned. You know, it's very hard, as you well know, after you give someone something to take it away, especially when it's $700. Like, that's a lot to give up.
A month. That's a lot.
And so they immediately, or maybe after the first 2 weeks, they surveyed the service members and said, you know, what do you think? And they said, we're just happy to have the dining hall back. They actually preferred it to having the allowance, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, I did find that surprising. If it was a smaller allowance, maybe, but like that's a pretty significant amount of food.
Really
but
significant.
I guess, you know, if you don't have a place to cook it, you're out eating, having to go find food somewhere, and maybe just the convenience of being able to go.
I think that's exactly. I mean, I think, you know, we think about food differently because it's something, you know, we look for it and we write about it. And to, you know, but if you're just trying.
And I have a real kitchen.
Right. But, right, exactly. So, I mean, how healthy can you eat at Waffle House if that's their concern? You know, they're probably happy about that. But probably, too, if what they care about most is, I don't know what Air Force people do. I don't know. Navigate? I don't know what it is.
Some navigate.
Whatever it is they do. Okay. So if, you know,
fixing
a plane is your top priority, you're probably happiest to have a place to go get lunch. So.
Well, I do recall because I really did get sick of the dining hall after the first glorious semester of all burgers and cereal. And so I did start going to the little grocery store nearby and trying to cook in the dorm. It was really tough cooking in the dorm because, A, you have no pots and pans when you're a college kid.
Right.
You know, I think I borrowed a couple old pots from my mom. Yeah, took them. And then you have this crummy little kitchen with like a little four burner stove. And and you have to like go, you know, it's just not pleasant. There's no, you know, you have to pack all your stuff down, wash it, take it back to your room. So I can see why if you're living in a place without your own kitchen,
right.
You know, cooking is sort of a hassle.
Yeah.
Well, I do think it's interesting. That's, you know, I think that you in the article you referenced one of the Air Force leaders calling it food 2.0.
Yes.
So that's definitely food 2.0 for our servicemen and our college students too. Mm-hmm. Another class of people who have a difficult time eating well is politicians when they're on the stump, because you're going from one place to another and eating at all kinds of restaurants. If you're in South Carolina, at least if you're in the middle part of the country, you're eating at all these a lot of breakfasts at these diners where the local Democratic or Republican Party has their little county club come out. Kamala Harris, Senator from California, who has announced – she has officially announced, I think. Announced candidate for president for 2020 was here in South Carolina making the rounds. And not surprisingly, if you're in the Carolinas, you're probably going to eat a little barbecue. And in her case, she picked – where you pick is always interesting. She picked Rodney Scott's Barbecue here in Charleston, South Carolina. I have to fully endorse it. If you're in Charleston, it's a great place to pick. But apparently not everyone agrees with me. Hannah, I think you had a little social media.
This was this past Friday. That's for when we're taping out. It's past Friday. And so I was supposed to meet my friend Adrian Miller, who's also a food writer, for lunch. And we may mention this previously on the program. He's now working on a book about black pitmasters. So he was interviewing Rodney on Friday morning, and we were going to get together after his interview. And he texted, he said, I think you should just come here. I think you may not want to miss this. So I go there for Kamala Harris's arrival, and she comes to eat. And so, of course, I tweet out that she was there and, you know, she was trying to decide what to order. And then I tweet out what she did order.
Oh, so you were like live tweeting.
Oh, I was live. I was there with my camera recording, you know, why didn't she eat her hush puppies? I was there, you know, the really important stuff.
I got to say, politics, boy, that's a third rail. Barbecue will raise passions. Well, what happens when you cross barbecue and
don't
politics?
Forget race.
And race, yes.
I could not believe the responses I got. Like, just, I mean, right. So you hear from all the Republicans, you hear from all the racists, and then you hear from all the people who are ignorant about barbecue. So, I mean, there was a whole thread of tweets about, well, I don't know, if you don't get brisket, I don't know what kind of presidential candidate you are.
Oh, guys, the Texans.
Exactly. Oh, they're man, all the weighted. They're
the,
all
the
weighted.
Brisket yeah. partisans had to
So I heard
in.
About brisket. I heard about, you know, whether you should have sauce or not on your barbecue. I heard about all sorts of barbecue opinions, many of them extremely uninformed. and so one of the opinions that was cited frequently, which is why I wanted to bring this up with you today, Robert, was, well, if you're going to win South Carolina, you should demand mustard sauce on your barbecue. I pointed out that there are diverse traditions in South Carolina, which was not accepted. But, you know, I have not looked at the map as to where our voters are and you know, where they fall in the state and the sauce tradition. So I wondered if you agree that if you are going to win South Carolina, which has become the state for Democrats to win, you should declare love for mustard sauce.
Well, if I was to take it simply as a matter of demographics, yeah. and if I want to say – Where will I get more votes?
Right.
If I go to the mustard-based regions and get all their votes,
right.
but lose the vinegar sauce.
yeah.
Or if I win vinegar sauce but lose mustard. Well, if I was those political maps.
I'm sure it's how they're talking about
yeah,
it. In
well,
their,
if I got my
their,
political map, yeah. I got the yellow yep. got the yellow counties mm-hmm. and I got the red counties.
Yep.
You definitely want to go for the yellow counties.
Yep.
And the reason for that is just simple demographics. You got the Midlands, Columbia, the capital city, and Lexington, two you know large cities.
Yep.
You got Charleston, North Charleston, Mount Pleasant. You know, even though Rodney is here now with vinegar sauce, this is still mustard territory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's still the primary. So if you got to win the cities, that's where all the people are. The PD region, mm-hmm. which is where you know Rodney's sauce comes from, it's very sparsely populated. It's just really you know it's a lot of swamp. It's
right.
a lot of rural area.
Right.
You know, there's not a whole lot of large towns up there. But, so there's just not that many votes.
But so do you, in your role as campaign consultant, will you advise your presidential candidates to placate whoever it is who's provided them barbecue or to really take a stand and try and win over mustard region? Say, I will not eat your barbecue.
No. The best thing to do is you go to the vinegar-based places, eat yeah. it and say how great it is. Then you go to the mustard-based places, eat it and say how great it is. And you win over
all
of them.
All things to all people.
Yeah, that's Emory, how you
would
win.
That be your approach to winning South Carolina?
Oh boy. Yeah, I think so. I was watching a lot of this happen on Twitter at the same time, and I saw a lot of the same takes. It was also interesting to see a lot of national takes on it. Robert, one of the takes that I was going to mention because it seemed right up your alley. In fact, I started Googling it and I landed on an article you'd written. This person was saying, actually, barbecue is not the correct regional food to order in South Carolina, you should get shrimp and grits.
Well, if it's breakfast time.
yeah. I would say not at Rodney's.
No, I mean, yeah,
well,
no.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
You have a point. They have a point in that, not South Carolina. Because
mm-hmm.
certainly.
Well, in the low country.
Now, if
yeah.
you're in Charleston in the low country, yes, barbecue does not have a long.
Right.
Proud tradition in the low country. The mustard sauce tradition we have was imported with the Bessinger brothers from and the Dukes from Orangeburg County down here right after World War II. So, yeah, shrimp and grits runs a lot deeper. It is definitely unique. But if it's lunchtime, shrimp and grits used to be, if you want to be like that particular about it, that was a breakfast dish. So
mm-hmm.
what you should do is have shrimp and grits for breakfast and then go have some barbecue for lunch because why not?
And this is why the candidates put on 20
out.
Pounds.
That's right. and they go one after the other after the
but
other.
But I'm so excited about this, about all these folks coming here to eat because,
yeah.
I mean, Iowa and New Hampshire are fine, but we have a better food.
Yeah.
There's
meat,
no question.
Loose meat sandwich? I mean,
right.
that's the best you can come up with.
Right. When
yeah.
I mean, you can have the pork tenderloin.
Or that pork thing, the hubcap
mm-hmm.
size.
Yep,
pork,
yep.
Pork, pork,
you can't eat a lot of pork.
Thing.
I don't know what they eat in New Hampshire. Syrup?
A lot of maple
Johnny
syrup
cakes.
on your pancakes.
I don't know what you're required to eat when you go to New Hampshire.
Sure
I do
there's
think it's
something.
Like, I think they spend a lot of mornings in diners.
Yeah.
That seems to be my sense
diners
of it.
Diners for sure. But diners, I think you can get away with as a politician because you don't have to sit down and necessarily eat.
Right, just shake
like,
hands.
You get a cup of coffee or a diner, you're chatting, and you can go to a whole bunch of diners. And
right.
You don't have to go, you know, one after another.
Right, because I don't think New Hampshireites, I don't even know what they call themselves,
yeah.
New Hampshireans, I don't think they're as identified with food as people are here. And so I think people do expect to see you eat.
Yeah. And the campaign barbecue, you know, going to a barbecue restaurant is actually, you know, it's one thing, but
it's easier to schedule.
Particularly if you're running, yeah, but if you're running for statewide office, particularly in North Carolina, there's just a circuit of community barbecues
right.
that you go through, and they stage, the parties will stage, you know, a countywide barbecue, and you just have to make the rounds of them. And it's,
sure.
you have to eat a whole lot of pork one after another.
Right.
After another. In fact, there was a candidate for governor, Rufus Edmonston, okay. back mm-hmm, in the, mm-hmm. I think, 70s or 80s, at some point got called on open mic saying, if I ever have to eat another plate of damn barbecue.
Right.
You know, and
although they do, there's also that fried fish circuit. I mean, Clyburn does
yes,
a,
yeah.
a fish
there
dinner.
There is always. The, what's the Gallivant's Ferry?
Yeah, fish? Gallivant's Ferry stop is.
Yeah, is it a fish fry? Or
I was
is it
just
a,
there this last time around. Wait.
Yeah, yeah, so Gallivant's Ferry, which that's just the name Gallivant's Ferry is begin with, but it's Chicken Bog.
Right, so you do Chicken Bog there. So, I mean, at least candidates here get there. It's diverse. You yep. get your Chicken Bog, you've got yep. your fried fish, you've got your barbecue. So we've got all your important meats covered.
That's right.
But I am curious, one last thing, which is what mistakes do you think a candidate might make food-wise, if not to not eat mustard sauce or whatever? You know, you
one
always think about the New Yorkers eating pizza yeah. with a knife and fork.
One mistake everybody makes mm-hmm. Is they go to Charlotte, North Carolina, and then mm-hmm. declare how great the barbecue is in Charlotte. And then everybody in North Carolina laughs at them because
right.
everybody knows – you know, there is no good. Well, no good. But that, you know,
right.
Charlotte
sure.
is not a mecca of barbecue,
mm-hmm.
As John Shelton Reed, esteemed sociologist, would put it. You know, you should drive like 40 miles to Shelby.
I was going to say, because I think of that as Charlotte, but I guess it's not. Bridges.
No, it's yeah. out. Yeah, it's outside of it. Yeah. And you know, obviously, Lexington, North Carolina has a great barbecue tradition, as yeah. the Eastern North Carolina. Charlotte, not so much. So that's one thing. Don't go praise Charlotte as a great barbecue mecca. People will laugh at you. Now, they would have done that in Charleston, you know, 10 years ago, but Charleston's barbecue game has gone way up. So I think, you know, Kamala Harris can go there, I think, with pride because she's not eating at some second-rate barbecue joint. So what was it you're asking?
Well, I'm just wondering if there's any mistakes that one might make in South Carolina that's going to end up just being all over Twitter, because how could they have – whatever.
Anything where you start trying to you got to be careful what you declare
mm-hmm.
Is you know if you go to a South Carolina place and you get brisket and you say, well, I always love getting brisket in South Carolina, well, you're going to get shellacked on Twitter because everybody knows brisket. You know, go to Texas to get brisket. Don't try it in South Carolina.
Right. I'm trying to think of a mistake along the lines. You always hear about candidates eat the tamales without taking the
yes.
husk off, or again, the pizza with the knife and fork. I'm trying to think of like an elementary mistake.
Well, one of the things that I thought was interesting, people were, I think, bringing this up a little tongue in cheek, but one of the other candidates who has declared, Cory Booker, is famously a vegetarian. And so people were saying,
right.
this is a little bit of shade on him, because obviously, like, what would he order at Rodney Scott's? What would you do if you're a vegetarian and like running for president?
The banana pudding's the thing to get at Rodney's, so
yeah.
he'll be fine. I mean, I do think it could be a lot of sweets mm-hmm. ahead for him.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. I'm also thinking like when he's in Iowa, you know, roaming around those like little mom and pop cafeterias, they'll be veggies, but they'll, you know, at least in South Carolina, they'd have meat in them.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to really be careful about the veggies that you get.
Right.
Especially at barbecue joints, there's bound to be a big old hunk of pork in your
mm-hmm.
greens.
I mean, it sounds silly, but I wonder if that actually could be a liability.
I think
it definitely can be. It's going to alienate the everyday Joe kind of person who, you know, I want to have a beer with my candidate. Maybe.
Yeah, I would not discount any of this. I mean, just seeing the response to that tweet when we're so early on, and it seems so just negligible in the scheme of things, but people really put a lot of stock into it.
Well, they mm-hmm. do, and there's all kinds of, you know, you got, as a politician, like everything like that is just fraught with risk, because you're rarely going to go to a place and they'll say, oh, I saw him eating barbecue, therefore, and that turned his campaign around and he won or she won.
Mm-hmm.
But very likely you could have your Dukakis moments in the tank where you get that,
right.
that
right.
one –
that's what I mean.
Picture or that one slip up where you go to Rodney Scott's and say, wish he had brisket,
mm-hmm.
and then the pitchforks come out.
Right.
You can't really do anything but screw up. It's like you're playing defense the entire time, I think,
right.
when you're out eating food like that.
Mm-hmm.
And also, but that is an interesting idea. People put – it's so weird that – not weird. I think it's very human, but we can talk about policies and all that kind of stuff, but I think with a lot of voters, it just comes down to – is this somebody I can connect with? And therefore, you know, it's the old, do I want to have a beer with them or do I want to go have lunch with them?
Right.
If you see them out there and they're eating something weird or something that you wouldn't want to eat, then.
Oh, I got one. What about ordering oysters out of season, which I know isn't the thing anymore, right. But how many people know that?
Right. That's a really tricky one. That would be, that's an interesting one.
Don't get champagne at the oyster roast. I think we learned
that one. These are Democrats we're talking about.
It goes both ways. Republicans will make their tour through as well.
Yeah, I suppose. But the primary really matters for the Democrats. I mean, yeah. I don't know if anyone's running against
Trump
or not.
That's true. At this stage of the game, no.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah. I was thinking more. You know, statewide politics.
I don't think you would have made it as far as declaring a presidential candidacy if you were ordering champagne and oyster roast. Not in this party. I don't think so.
But we'll see because South Carolina is definitely a battleground state. So all that dozen or more already declared. How many more we'll see? Three dozen candidates will come rolling through here at some point.
Well, that's exactly right. And I was asking someone at Rodney's, is Rodney going to feed everybody? You know, I mean, Rodney is famously apolitical, so I cannot see him, you know, declaring. I don't think he's going to endorse. Yeah. I really don't see him being like, oh, only this candidate can eat here. He probably will entertain everyone, but it will be interesting to see if people end up taking sides along the way.
Well, this is, you can get into a lot of like hot water right there just in downtown Charleston where you pick your barbecue.
Yep.
Even though, you know, the barbecue community here, they're all on very good terms. They're all friends and everything. But you can see how everything's very symbolic.
Everything's symbolic. So, Senator Harris, when she went to her rally following lunch, or, you know, went out to North Charleston. And the thing she was talking about that was most memorable for her was the cornbread. And we've talked before about how cornbread is made different.
Talk about lightning rod.
There's a racial divide over cornbread.
Did she mention sugar one way or another?
She didn't mention it one way or another. She just said she said, I'm still thinking about that cornbread. Maybe she was still thinking about the racial ramifications.
I think there could be a risk going to Rodney's too, just in that sauce is spicy. If you pour on a little extra on there, you start eating it, and then all of a sudden you're on camera and you're choking up and you can't talk. And you're probably safer to stick with the cornbread, which is not going to, like or scorch your tongue.
It's going to be an interesting campaign season. Yeah.
Well, at least I approve of the choice, kicking it off with a bang.
And that is all for this edition of The Winnow. We recorded today's episode in the Electable Podcasting Studios at the Post and Courier building
in
downtown Charleston, South Carolina. If you enjoy listening to The Winnow, help other listeners find us too. Just go to iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you access your podcasts and like us or leave a rating. The Winnow is a production of the Post and Courier and Palmetto New Media. Our producer today was naturally sweet, J.M.R.E. Parker. Our theme music is by the Bluestone Ramblers.
Until next time, I'm Robert Moss.
And I'm Hannah Raskin.
Now get out there and eat.